This is Maria Rizaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I'll interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. In this episode, we tackle all the big issues of life. Deep questions, you know, the meaning of life, nihilism. Does the world need storytellers to make sense out of life and out of life events? And of course, that includes that seminal question that has plagued our generation. Is shameless bribery a legitimate parenting technique? Well, David Benn, our writer under the spotlight, tackles this question fearlessly. Being a single dad is not an unusual thing these days, but writing a book of short stories that so beautifully describe the travails of being a father, well, that is a little bit more unusual. When David joined our infamous Tuesday Night Writers Group, armed with a ream of clever and witty stories about relationships and travel tales, I more than half suspected he attended to make his dating profile more interesting. You know, hobbies, bushwalking, listening to live music, attending a writer's group, working on the great Australian novel. Much to his surprise, and the whole writer's group, in fact, he unwittingly found the holy grail of all writers everywhere. His own true writer's voice. Blow me down. It is the one thing that writers everywhere just ache to achieve. You can write proper, you can write lucid and articulate, and you can write clever. But developing your own voice, the one where people want to just keep listening to you because there is nothing but a whispery vapour between you and the writing muse, that takes practice and skill, lots of honing and self-examination. So what is it that provided David with this impetus? I'm convinced that it was Tuesday Night Writers Group. It started at 6 p.m. and we were all hungry and tired and desperate for a drink, which we knew would be our reward at the friendly warm pub across the road, where we would all cluster to lick our wounds. So critiques were not exactly in the vein of gentle encouragement and compassion. No. The looks of derision at times, well, what can I say? You felt like a fish being scaled while still flapping. Months later, all the members of that group formed the type of solid bond that writing forges. And David just flourished. His critiquer is professional writer Bronwyn Birdsall. I knew that Bronwyn had written a beautiful article about being a godparent, with all the care and responsibility that that involved. I was definitely interested in how she was going to approach the whole subject of David's very frank, never-miss-a-beat approach to parenting. Which brings us right back to our first premise. What will Bronwyn think of sheer, unadulterated bribery as a way of moderating your children's behaviour? Here we go. I did promise you a wide variety of writers, and I'm very pleased to introduce David Benn. Hello, David.
And hello, Maria.
You've been writing now for something like 2 years, and by that I mean writing with tending to publish. And this is definitely not your day job, which is
a jeweler.
Are there any correlations between what you do as a day job and the way that you write?
There are very few correlations, and writing has been a skill that I've had to really work at. It takes time, and obviously my work really doesn't allow any time for that at all. Mm. Writing is taken up in my spare time, writing on weekends, writing on holidays, writing after work.
Have you always written?
I have always written, but I've never taken it seriously. I was told when I was younger that no one really makes a living out of writing. No one really makes a living out of fine arts. No one really makes a living as a painter. No one really makes a living as a musician.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for myself, I took all that on board. But it's only now, when you hit a midlife crisis, that you decide to take it seriously.
I have been listening to your writing over the last, I think it's been about a year and a half. It seems to me that you've become a far better writer than you were right at the beginning in terms of being able to reach an audience. Is that something that is right for me to say? Or
I think at the start, I was trying to be clever. Now I'm actually trying to make the reader feel something.
What I've really loved about your writing is when you hit on that very rich vein of talking about you as a father and writing stories about your sons, being with your kids and being the best parent that you can without looking as if you're perfect. Do you want to describe how that evolved, deciding that you're going to write those stories?
It actually came about with a short conversation I had with yourself, and I'm going to quote you.
Okay.
And I think your quote was something along the lines of, David, I'm not saying that I don't feel anything from your writing, but it really doesn't affect me. It didn't leave you feeling anything. And so when someone says that to you, you need to either throw it away and forget about it and keep going, or take it on board and find something that will move a reader. You're right. What I was writing may have been clever, may have been entertaining, but it didn't leave you feeling anything.
I mean, I can't believe I said something so villainous to you, but I certainly wouldn't be able to say anything like that about your current writing, which is your collection of short stories, because they are very moving and there are episodes that you write about that remain with me as a listener. And I suppose it's having been part of a writer's group where you start to trust each other and be able to take on each other's feedback.
The writer's workshops were invaluable for me because they hold up a mirror. It's up to the writer whether they look into the mirror or don't. But I think if you want to improve as a writer, you need to look at yourself. You really need to take yourself on board. I think also to improve as a writer, you need to write with emotion, affect your audience. Very important. If your audience walks away unaffected by what you've written, it actually lacks meaning.
So how much your real life now intrudes with your writing and vice versa? Because I know I find as a writer now, an event will happen and I'm thinking, oh, I've got to get that down. That's like a really nice episode. Instead of just like going, oh yeah, that was sad or that was, exciting. It's like, no, this is good material for writing. Is that the point that you've reached?
Well, the short answer to that is yes. But a lot of what happens in life has no meaning. It doesn't have a finish. It doesn't have an end. Events in a book all add up to an outcome.
Well, you're a father. You work full time. You've got a business. You've got parents. And what role does writing play in all that for you?
Writing is something of an escape for me. It is a cathartic experience. I'm a single father, so I have the boys every second weekend. Now, the weekends you don't have the boys, it stops me dwelling on being alone. So yeah, it's very easy as a single parent to suffer the loneliness of a weekend without children.
Yeah.
So to fill that time up, I fill it with writing.
How far into that collection of short stories are you into now? Like, have you given yourself a deadline or are you just going to let them spill out as they go along?
I've finished a dozen short stories. I've developed a conclusion, which is vastly important when you're writing a book. So I'm at the stage now where I could link these short stories together with the help of a few chapters and I would have a book.
If you had to give advice to other people about taking up writing, what would it be?
I think you need to find something to write about. A lot of your writing initially would be a search to find something that you can write about and give it emotion, give it feeling, give it depth, give it reality. That is very important. Don't be surprised if, like myself, when you start writing, you write a whole lot of things that never reach fruition until you find that one thing that you do write about. And it won't be the thing that you expect. I didn't expect writing about my children have any interest for an audience until I read it to a writing group. And goodness me, they applauded.
Yes, I know. I was shocked. All stunned. It was just so beautiful.
I could actually write something with depth and meaning. Yeah, I surprised myself too.
Thank you so much, David, for this interview. I invite you now to read something of yours so that we can get a sense of your uniqueness as a writer. Do you have something for us?
I do. It's a short story I wrote during the school holidays. Screen time. It took me quite a while to get over my eldest son being shot in the face with an assault rifle. I walked out of his bedroom with a dry mouth, trembling hands, and a vacant space in my head. In silence, I sat in the kitchen and tried to comprehend the experience. All he did was sigh and shrug his shoulders. At the time he was shot in the face, he was dressed as a young woman, in a pink hoodie, with little cat ears and black framed glasses. Rather than some sexually aggressive bionic girl, he was just a sweet young woman in tights and trainers. The type of young woman I see getting on the 438 bus every morning on her way to the University of Technology, with backpack slung over her shoulder, and headphones covering her ears. Perhaps it was because his skin was so familiar that seeing her being shot in the face and subsequently eliminated from the game was so penetrating. It was like being stabbed in the heart. I wondered if I was perhaps too hasty in agreeing to purchase the PS4 and download Fortnite. Alison had a blanket ban on all technology at her house. They have Taekwondo to practice, homework to complete, and books to read. They have no time to sit in front of a screen. No iPads, no phones, and certainly no gaming consoles. Having no such ban at my house, I was continually being asked, much to my chagrin, where I had left my phone, and if it had any charge in it. The first time I heard of Fortnite was when Tom threw himself face first into my lap as I was watching football one Sunday afternoon and told me he hated his life as I lay back in the large white leather lounge with my legs up on the coffee table, my 11-year-old son buried his head in my lap, wrapped his arms around my waist and cried that he couldn't go to school anymore because he doesn't have anything to say to any of his friends. I looked down at him for a few seconds. Then over a buddy, who was sitting in the matching white leather armchair beside me, his legs curled underneath him, staring at my phone. He didn't even look up at me. Tom wants you to buy a PS4. Buddy, take your feet off the chair. I don't want you marking it. I looked down at Tom. Is that right? Everyone is playing Fortnite except me. A PS4 costs $400 and Fortnite is already loaded onto it. Buddy could really be quick, or perhaps my next question was really obvious. I put my hand on the back of Tom's head. It was a quick decision. I didn't like seeing him left out, and if all his friends had PS4s, then obviously their parents didn't have an issue with it. I tell you what, guys, if you give me $100 each out of your Christmas and birthday money, then I'll donate the rest and we can get a PS4. How does that sound? Tom's head shot up. Can we get one now? Now? I felt trapped. Yes, now. Buddy had torn his head from the phone and was staring at me, his eyes searching for a sign of capitulation or an ingenuine offer. We put our trainers on, and, taking $100 from each of their money jars, I drove them down to the large shopping mall on Broadway. JB Hi-Fi is packed with electronic devices, festooned with yellow banners, and signs covered in large black letters proclaiming discounts and low prices. Skinny, disaffected teenagers dressed in ripped jeans and ill-fitting t-shirts wander up and down the aisles of phones, tablets, laptops, and gaming consoles. I was able to identify the shop staff from the yellow ribbons holding their electronic identity tags that were draped around their necks. We purchased the PS4 from a tall, skinny teenager with pasty white skin, greasy shoulder-length hair, and large gold-framed glasses. It'll be these two guys who will be playing it. Yes, this isn't for me, and I wondered who he thought would be playing it. He smiled a little and looked me in the eye. Okay then, Fortnite is already loaded on this console, and that's fine for kids, but check the rating of all games before you purchase them. A lot of games are quite violent and explicit, and really not suitable for children. Yes, thank you for letting me know. He knew it wasn't for me. I'd just been worked out by a skinny teenage boy, and had been found a babe in the woods. A dad with no idea was purchasing Pandora's Box. He sold me a pair of headphones and mic as well. I handed him my card. We walked out of the shop, each boy holding a handle with the large plastic bag containing our PS4 swinging between them. At home, I set the PS4 up in Tom's room. It was only a matter of minutes later that Tom was yelling down the microphone to his friends and coursing his skin over the virtual terrain of the game. I told him not to yell. I wondered if he could hear me over the sound of the gunfire. There's no point yelling down a microphone. He said he was sorry and stopped yelling, but gradually the volume increased. I walked back upstairs to close his bedroom door, but instead decided to spend a minute or two watching him play. The game so captivated him. It was then I saw him get shot in the face. I sat in the kitchen contemplating our recent purchase and the death of my son's character. I saw Buddy look up from his iPad, hop off the lounge and bounce up the stairs. I heard Tom stop yelling into the microphone and then start shouting at Buddy. I watched as Buddy slowly walked down the stairs, shoulders slumped, head hanging. Dad, Tom's time is up and he won't get off the PS4. He says he just wants to finish his game. Will it take very long for him to finish the game? It doesn't matter. When that game is over, he'll just start another one. Will you come upstairs and tell him to get off? Well, before I do that, could we try something else first? What? Buddy asked glumly. I bought you both a tube of Pringles yesterday, when I picked you up from school, right? Right. Who do you think likes Pringles more? Tom does. Buddy knew this all too well, having caught his older brother eating his Pringles after having eaten all his own on several occasions. Buddy had taken to hiding them. What would you prefer to do, Buddy? Play Fortnite or eat Pringles? play Fortnite. So why don't you take your Pringles, put them on the coffee table in front of the TV, and then we'll go upstairs and say to Tom, Tom, if you get off the PS4 now and let me have an extra 20 minutes, then you can have all my Pringles. Buddy looked at me for a few seconds, then walked to the kitchen. I opened up the cupboard where all the plastic and old Tupperware was stored. He rummaged around for a while before withdrawing a red Pringles tube and put it on the coffee table. He stood at the bottom of the stairs. Will you come upstairs to help me? Yeah, I can do that. I followed Buddy up to Tom's room. Tom sat on his bed, his back up against the wall. He was yelling encouragement and criticism down the microphone to his friends. Buddy stood at the end of the bed. Tom looked over at him. What? If you get off the PS4 now and give me an extra 20 minutes, then you can have all my Pringles that are in the tube on the coffee table. Tom frowned. An extra 20 minutes? Standing behind Buddy, I leant forward and stared Tom in the eye. That's a good offer, Tom. Tom looked at me and his face softened. He spoke softly into the mic. Okay, guys, I gotta go. My brother Buddy will be playing for a while. Tom logged out of the game, slipped the microphones from his head, and handed them to Buddy. There you go. He walked off quietly. Thanks, Tom. That was a good decision. I felt a little glow of pride as I watched Buddy slip the microphones on and heard Tom hop down the stairs to the lounge room. I sat on the bed beside Buddy, watching him join his friends and listening to him talk loudly down the microphone. Then I heard the ominous thumping of heavy footsteps climbing the stairs. I turned to see Tom standing in the doorway, Pringles tube in one hand, his other hands clenched in a fist as he stared at Buddy. He threw himself across the room. I caught him just before he was able to crash headlong into his little brother. Teeth clenched, he snarled, "Let me go! I'm gonna fucking bash him!" With my arms wrapped around his waist, it took all my strength to hold Tom back. Buddy crouched at the far end of the bed, pressing himself into the corner of the room, with one eye on me and one eye on Tom, and glancing back towards the screen. He was still trying to play Fortnite. "Tom, you're not allowed to bash Buddy!" Tom tried to claw away from me. He edged closer to Buddy. Buddy tries to push himself further into the corner. "I hate him. You say I'm not allowed to bash him, but he forces me to bash him." The sound of automatic gunfire filled the room. Buddy yelled at me, "Hold him back, Dad. I'm trying to kill someone." Buddy and I struggled for a few seconds before he collapsed onto the floor. Finally, I felt Tom relax my arms, and in turn, I softened my grip on him. "Tom, why do you want to bash Buddy?" "Look." Tom handed me the red tube. There was nothing inside. I looked up at Buddy. "Dude, you would have known Tom was going to be upset when you saw there was no Pringles in the tube." Buddy didn't take his eyes off the screen. "But it was a really good plan. I wanted to see if it would work." I felt the blood rising to my face. "Buddy, it was only a good plan. It was only ever going to work if there were Pringles in the tube." I stared at him. "Otherwise, it's a rip-off, and it was only ever going to make him angry." I was certain Buddy understood this. He glanced at me sheepishly. "Sorry, Dad." I pushed myself up from the floor and helped Tom to his feet. "Buddy, you can have an hour on the PS4. You can't have the extra 20 minutes. Buddy's jaw dropped. He looked like he was about to protest, but then closed his mouth. I turned to Tom. "Tom, Buddy does not make you bash him. It's your decision to bash him." Tom spread his arms, incredulous. "How can you say that?" "Wait, Tom. He will make you want to bash him, but it is your decision to actually hit him." I turned back to Buddy. "Dude, I'm going to get very tired very quickly of protecting you from Tom if you're going to provoke him. Do you understand?" Buddy looked at me, the controller in his lap. "Yes, Dad." I pointed down the PS4. "And I'm going to get very tired of this thing in the house if all you guys are ever going to do is fight over it." I pushed Tom out of the room, and we left Buddy behind. The sound of yelling and gunfire followed us down the stairs.
And that was David Benn reading from his short story, Screen Time. And in the critique part of the section, we have Bronwyn Birdsall. Bronwyn also discusses how she found her writer's voice, and it took a very different route, one that involved the grueling process of writing a memoir, which she describes as unpeeling herself. She's an accomplished professional writer in the commercial world of marketing, which is so competitive that only the truly talented wordsmiths succeed. And her journey is one of crossing that pretty long turbulent river between the taught writing required by her day job and onto those shores of literary fiction writing. So welcome, Bronwyn, to the program.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Before we start, just tell me a little bit about your background.
I am probably what you'd call an emerging writer, I guess. I like the idea that emerging isn't related to age.
Yes, that's right. Right.
Yeah, it's different to be a young writer, emerging. But about a year ago now, I finished my first novel. Long and rewarding process. And the last year, it's kind of been doing the rounds of agents and publishers and things. But at the moment, it's being considered by a publisher I'm really excited about.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, you're also a professional writer.
Yes, I'm a marketer, probably, or a comms or communications person.
Yeah. Tell me that a little bit about writing professionally and writing as a creative writer, because you've had that experience more recently.
The big difference is that in professional writing, you're usually writing to a specific purpose. You're writing to an aim. And how it differs to my creative writing, it's about me finding my way to a story, and it's almost a different language.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying. So, Bronwyn, I saw you taking a lot of notes while you were listening to David's work and looking really pensive, but you did giggle at one stage. So what were your thoughts?
My first note that I made was great opening line.
It was very dramatic. I was a little bit shocked by it when I first heard it, and it took me a while for my mind to kind of uncurl and sort of hear that, oh, okay, it's part of a game, you know, with that was going on. It wasn't some mad dystopia he was describing. And really, it unfolds into this beautiful domestic scene.
Yeah, and I thought it was actually so much of the stories about physicality, even with the people who are selling the game at JB Hi-Fi, but there's physicality all the way through it. So in some ways, that opening line really sets up that this is a story about bodies and about visceral experience.
It's interesting because there's a particular skill in being able to describe a small, non-momentous a little patch of life. And something that you use the word immersive, that's what I found. I was immediately immersed in that whole scene. Yeah, you get your attention drawn by the shocking parallel universe that's inside the game. And then also you become immersed in the domestic drama, which is simply about parenting, the intimacy of that family relationship.
I found it very effective as a story in the sense of I had a strong sense of his internal experience. For me, that's quite a good marker of a story because I'm not a part-time dad. I'm not a parent, actually. When I was listening to it, it's very easy to have opinions about things like screen time, as the story is called, from a distance.
Yeah.
But it's very different when, as he described, his child's got his hands around him. And especially an 11-year-old to be that physically close.
Yeah.
And the dilemma, like nothing is simple in this, in that decision-making.
Yeah, was an interesting way that he was unraveling that whole issue without going into any major explanations. It was just being confronted with a child who wants to be part of his group and needs this mechanism. You know, I can remember being like that when I was a child as well. It's something we can relate to. So he's not preaching in any way, just saying, well, this is the way I dealt with it and this was the experience I had. And this was the outcome. And there's no, like life, there's a lot of areas where there is no specific right or wrong. And I know you're not a parent, but I know that you've got children that are close to you.
It's true. I think the thing that I really appreciated was when he said, okay, like he sets up what he thinks is a sort of hypothetical situation, a hypothetical scenario that if we get this money, then we can. And he's kind of talking in the future, like, and the kids, They see the opportunity and they just pounce on it.
So we're going now. Yeah, and I love the way that he's strategizing, you know, strategizing for the diplomatic outcome, you know, and which falls flat. And yet he's able to, okay, well, let's go back to square one. And that's what being a parent is all about, you know, one stuff up after another with absolutely the best intentions. I love it in scenarios like this where the kids just get the better of the adults all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
So where did it hit you? Was it funny or informative or?
Probably more towards poignant, actually.
Yeah,
By having that very everyday, like it's what, one afternoon or one evening.
Yeah.
It's so much, well, maybe not poignant. It's probably more insightful because what we saw is so much more insight than if he was to say to us, this is my experience of being a weekend only dad, or, you know, like you got a lot out of the story.
Yeah.
As in, you got a lot of insight, I should say, out of the story as to what his experience. And also maybe a little bit into the sibling dynamic.
I mean,
I am a younger sibling, so I have to say that the Pringles story sounds like something I would have done. Short-term gain.
It's a, yeah, second child syndrome. Yeah, exactly. Exactly their tactics. I love that David is sharing these stories and he's got the skill to do it. You know, you don't often get men writing these types of stories. Certainly I've heard a few of them, and the characters of each of the boys evolves, and they're very different boys, you know. Just having a David as a dad dealing with both of them, describing those journeys that they're all going on, is really gorgeous. It's intimate. I think David exercises a lot of detail in his work. When you were saying it was physical before, there is very close observation of everything that's going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of observation in it. And I'd also say that I find one of the most beautiful things about being a reader as opposed to a writer. When you're a reader, you, no matter who it is that's writing, you get insight into a fellow human's experience.
Yes.
And as you said, perhaps there aren't many men writing about this particular experience. That whoever it is that's writing, if you write from that place of truth and experience, there's moments of reflection in there for all of us.
Yeah, I agree. Writing is a scouring process. And I think that's part of what David was trying to explain when I was interviewing him, was that he evolved as a writer and very clever, very witty, certainly could put two words together. The construction was great. Yet he could not help being more and more self-reflective the more he wrote, as he started writing things that were more meaningful to him and realised that the reaction he was having was also moving other people. It scoured him out even more. And I think as a writer you would know exactly what that's like.
I think so. I think, I mean, I had the experience of, I actually wrote a memoir that wasn't published.
Yeah.
Then ended up writing a novel, but with sort of similar themes. And what I learned, it takes a lot to unpeel yourself.
Yes.
And then the beautiful thing you hope that's within there is your voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so maybe I always had a capacity to write with voice, but maybe not necessarily the emotional depth to be able to express it. For me, writing that memoir, it allowed me to fail a bit, which is good.
Yes.
But also just, you know, that you just putting words on the page.
Yeah. And that's what David was saying.
Yeah. Exactly.
You've just got to get your pen onto that page and just keep writing and see what happens and see what subject starts to sing to you so that you can sing back at it, I suppose.
Yeah, it's nice. It's a nice metaphor.
I know that David has read this out to a group. This was completely unedited when he read this out, he admitted to me later. And certainly he read it out to a writer's group afterwards and we made suggestions. So if you had any editing tips, what would they be?
So my only editing tip, the dialogue could be shortened or tightened. It's just something that happens in the editing process. It's a normal a normal thing because there's a bit in it where the son says, "Will you come upstairs with me? And then he says, "Yes, I will."
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't
unnecessary.
You don't need the "yes, I
that's
will."
That's exactly what we all said. You know, that was just sort of tightening it up a bit.
Just for pacing and rhythm.
For pacing, because there are certain elements in the story that are really quite action-driven and riveting, and there are some beautiful pithy statements as well. In between, there's a little bit of clutter. David's great like this. He just takes down all these notes and then he cleans it up. There's no debate. Yeah.
I mean, that's how all of our writing progresses.
Exactly.
It's the normal standard thing. If someone listening didn't have that writing group around them, I would say the best writing advice I got early on was try to cut your sentence in half. But this is this really wondrous process where it goes from where you think you need all these words to communicate something, and then you kind of go from being a writer to an editor to a reader with your work, then it's so obvious what you can cut.
Yeah, it's interesting to be able to go through that whole cycle. Tom, look, thank you so much, Bronwyn.
You're welcome.
For your critique.
Thanks for having me here.
And the next interview will probably be with you as an emerging writer.
I hope so.
This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program, produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH with the support and inspiration of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I look forward to your company next time.